could you just walk me through the process of how you came to accept this commission?
At the time, this was 2007, 2008, I was in residence at the American Academy in Rome. I had the Rome Prize. And as my big project that year, I was writing a long piece about the history of the Jews of Rome. And I was using archival recordings that I had unearthed from the 1940s and 50s of Roman cantors. And for me, the fascination there was their music, the music of the Roman Jews, is very different from Ashkenazi music, from Sephardic music, from klezmer. It was a music that I had never even really heard before. And it came from their real segregation for hundreds of years living in the ghettos of Rome. And what that meant was through that forced living that there was an oral tradition that continued for generation after generation and produced an insular music that didn't change. And the fantasy for this community that came from Jerusalem, was expelled from Jerusalem about 100 years before Christ, was in Rome, living essentially isolated, holding on to that music which came from the temple in Jerusalem. Now, it's a fantastical notion. There's no way of corroborating it, but it's an idea that has mesmerized composers many, many centuries before me. In Bach's time, there were composers, Jewish and Christian alike, who were fascinated by that idea and trying to capture what is the true biblical music, as it were. And so I spent a year researching this music, and I wrote a piece that is in my voice as a contemporary composer with these recordings of these cantors, these old cantors, with a live singer singing in duet with these old recordings. And at that concert was a friend of the American Academy in Rome named Tom Blunt, who maybe some of you may know. His father was Red Blunt, who was a member of the Nixon cabinet. He was the last postmaster general and a prominent family in Alabama. Well, Tom Blunt heard that piece. He liked it. He wanted to commission me. And he brought me down to Alabama. And that's sort of the genesis of this piece. And I started to get to know Montgomery and then in Birmingham and started to understand the history of this place and started to see similarities between the history of the Roman Jews and the history of the African Americans in Birmingham.
At that time, what did you know about Birmingham and the civil rights struggles of the 1960s?
Very little. Very little. First, I met Morris Dees from the Southern Poverty Law Center and saw what was happening there, what this very important place was doing. And at first I thought that the piece that I would write would be not about the 16th Street Baptist Church or the history of Birmingham at all. I thought I would write a piece about extremism in general. And as I started delving through the material and the resources that the SPLC has, I realized that this would result in a piece full of fear, hate, and I felt like this was not the direction I wanted to go in. Then Tom Blunt brought me to Birmingham, and in Birmingham I saw the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute and started realizing that this was the place that I wanted to draw upon. And especially the Oral History Project, which is this incredible collection of voices telling their own personal stories about what's happened here.
Well, tell me more about that, because as you said, you studied oral histories at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. You interviewed civil rights foot soldiers. You looked through the files and artifacts at the Birmingham Public Library. What did you think that would be like before you did it? And once it was sort of complete, was it what you expected?
This has been a two-year process to make this work. And of those two years, I've spent maybe a year and a half really only thinking about the piece before I set one note down. And that process of thinking was mostly listening to people speak about their experiences here. I met with foot soldiers, with real heroes of the civil rights movement, with civil rights leaders living today. And I got a sense of what is important to citizens of Birmingham, what has been said too much about this story, what has not been said enough about this story, and mostly that the consensus was from black and white folks alike who I spoke with was that they had enough of listening to stories about dogs and water hoses and violence, that they felt that this city has been maligned too long, and they wanted a work that had something to do with hope. And I, of course, took that all in and naturally, in the end, created my own work, my own vision, because I had to make my own path into this story. But that path is a hopeful one, because in the 2 years that I've been coming to Birmingham, I've seen that the city is filled with hope and has moved so far forward in the last 50 years. It is really kind of a beacon of light in America, just as I find Germany to be a beacon of light in Europe for how one reacts to a history of tragedy and violence. Where do we go from there? I think that this is a really inspiring place today, Birmingham.
So in composing this piece, is this something you struggled with, the balance between looking back at what happened during 1963 at the 16th Street Baptist Church versus looking forward, as you said, and being sort of hopeful for the future?
Absolutely. The piece takes you on a journey from exploring the climate of fear that was here for many, many decades to a place filled with hope. It's a narrative, in a sense, but at the same time, it's an abstract work of art, one where I'm not trying to be totally literal. I'm not playing the role of a historian. I'm not telling Birmingham her own history. And so there is an abstraction to it in that I do want listeners to find their own path within my work for it to resonate within them in deeply personal ways. So there are moments in this piece where I can't tell you this is exactly about something that happened. In fact, the bombing is almost not mentioned at all in this entire piece. And so the piece becomes not about one isolated incident that happened in 1963, but about how we react in the face of injustice. How do each of us react to any kind of injustice? And that's where the title of my work comes from. A More Convenient Season refers to the letter from the Birmingham jail that Martin Luther King wrote. And he said that he felt that he's more afraid of the moderate than the extremist, the man who says, let's not do anything now. Let's not act now. Let's wait for a more convenient season. And I feel like at every opportunity, you have the opportunity to do nothing or do something. And Martin Luther King speaks of a positive peace and a negative peace, a passive peace versus an active peace. And I think that's the message that I'd like to come across for listeners who are aware or otherwise about what happened here in Birmingham in 1963.
The language at the time, though, was certainly, I guess, can best be described as vitriolic. You've said you've gotten words from FBI files, police records, words of the time. Would that, for example, include the N-word?
No. No, I don't do that. But I do get quite explicit in terms of being very frank with what the climate was like here. It was a climate of hate. And I tell the story in a way. I wanted to model this piece like a mass or a cantata or a large-scale piece, a passion by Bach, where there are these large choruses that happen that sort of are the point of the story. What is the point? What is the big message? And I struggled for a long time to find what is that message. And my entryway into this piece was this little story, a story of a small person making a small act of courage that showed me the link to Martin Luther King's letter, how we can all make a difference in small ways, an active, positive peace. And I tell the story of a little white girl named Pamela Walbert, who was about 11 years old in 1963, and wrote a fan letter to Reverend Shuttlesworth and got a response back, an invitation to Bethel Church to be part of a group to talk about civil rights. And she sat on the floor with all the other kids. There were very few other white children that day, very hot day in August, and there wasn't enough cans of Coke to go around. Now, she had been struggling with her faith during that time. She talks in this interview of her problems with taking the communion and what it meant to her. And she's also struggling at that moment with everything that she had been taught by teachers, schoolmates, that you shouldn't share a can of Coke with an African American. And she makes a choice in that moment to take that can, bring it to her lips, and drink from it. And she recounts that at that moment she feels the Holy Spirit coursing through her body. And that story to me was the entryway into this piece. And it was the entryway into the experience of a small act of courage, nothing heroic. Lives were not lost. No one went to prison. But for a small child making a move like that, it's something that we could all do, and not a lot of us do. And I come from a family that was deeply ravaged by World War II, by the Nazis. We lost many people. And yet no one in my family speaks about these things. So when I came to Birmingham and met with civil rights leaders and sat in a room with perfect strangers who were instrumental in the movement in the 1960s, and they told me about their lives, about the humiliations that they suffered, it was one of the most important conversations in my life, and it deeply affected my work.
So you're saying the stories, these individual acts of heroism, as you've just explained it, really are more of the overriding arc for you in the piece than, say, for example, just, you know, saying the N-word, even though that was part of the language at the time. Do I understand that right?
Well, I think that there are more powerful words and more powerful ways of affecting people than using inflammatory language. And I feel that often by an absence, you can have a stronger reaction. So while writing this piece, I was very conscious of not pouring salt into the wound, not creating a manipulative work of art. I constantly felt myself making decisions that were a fork in the road between the easiest solution and one that would perhaps not be so overt, but would make a point without being unbearable to listen through.
Can you tell me something specific in terms of dialogue that you heard from your visits to Birmingham that was incorporated into the piece?
I found two sets of questions that were very compelling. One was questions asked of African Americans who attempted to vote in the 1960s and previous to that, questions that are impossible to answer, like how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap, how high is height, how far is distance. The other set of questions were questions that the FBI and the police department in Birmingham asked suspects in the bombing. These are polygraph tests that have an amazing inherent structural dramatic nature to them that ratchet up in specificity from the most mundane questions to the most specific. Both sets of questions are sung in the second movement of my piece, and taken out of context, you simply don't know what this is about. And by virtue of that, by removing the history lesson out of it, the didactic nature of it, I am asking that a listener who doesn't know what this is about be curious and ask someone, why are we listening to these words? What do these words mean? What do they have to do with this history?
It seems like a lot of people see classical music as soothing or music they can have on in the background while doing other things. I once interviewed a musician who said, that's not music's job. To be soothing all the time. Would you Would you agree with that, certainly in light of the type of music you compose?
I think that that's the magic of music, that it can have so many different kinds of roles. And to say that music can't be soothing, I think, is a little disingenuous. It's not giving the whole story of the ability of music. And I think that the power of it is that every person can interpret it in a deeply personal way. I wanted to make a work that allowed each person sitting in the dark to reflect as though they were the only person sitting in that concert hall, that my music would give them the freedom to interact with it any way they want, without being dogmatic or preachy.
So how would you suggest then maybe someone approach a contemporary piece of classic music whereby there may not be an easily discernible melody?
I think that whether or not you have a degree in music, you need to approach a piece of music as though you've never heard any music before. Try not to bring any preconceptions to it, and let the music itself create a universe around you. In other words, it's like learning a new vocabulary, in a sense. Let the piece, as it unfolds, teach you its own vocabulary. And if it's a successful piece of music, it will do that. It will help you become part of the fabric of that work. I never like to hear people say or to preface their comments about a piece by saying, well, I never studied music, or I don't know anything about music. That's not how music works. Composers don't write music for other composers. They write music because they want people to experience it.
The audience is not just going to hear this piece. There's a visual aspect to this performance. There's a tactile aspect to this performance. Tell me about this multi-sensory approach that you're sort of taking to this piece.
I'm collaborating with a couple of amazing artists. One is this electronic music composer based in Brooklyn, New York, named Philip White. And another is another Brooklyner named David Peterson, who's made several documentary films for PBS about the civil rights movement. And with them, I've created a work that is more than just an orchestra piece. So when people enter the lobby of the hall where it's going to be performed, they'll immediately realize that this is not your grandmother's Beethoven concert, that music and music is present from the moment that you walk into the lobby. And you'll be hearing this tapestry of sounds that are created by linking the words of folks who recorded themselves for the Oral History Project at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute.
Present in the lobby before you get to the concert.
Before you even enter the hall, you'll hear these sounds. Now, these are the words that make up the actual libretto, the book, the text which will be sung in the piece. So it's almost a foreshadowing of what's to come. Along with this waves of low, low sound that you'll hear in the lobby, those low electronic sounds are a little they're somewhere between soothing and maybe disquieting, somewhere in that gray zone. And they'll tell us that this is not the usual concert experience. When the doors to the hall finally open and people walk in, they'll find that the orchestra is already on the stage, tuned, ready to go. The conductor is up there. There are no more trappings of the usual concert experience of clapping for the concertmaster, clapping for the conductor. We realize that we're in a different place, that we're doing something new tonight. And there is a seamless transition between all this sound that we're hearing, which carries from the lobby into the hall, to the moment when the orchestra begins playing. There's no big fanfare to mark the beginning of it, as though history is just proceeding right along, that there's no real change.
Why? Why do this approach?
Well, because I wanted to make a work that's more than just another piece for the concert repertoire. I felt like this was not just a piece of classical music. This was a work, in a sense, of public art that I had been asked to make. It's been really the greatest honor to make it, and I felt like I wanted to mark that day, September 15th, 1963, in a special way, in a way that differs from every other night.
Could you actually see this extending out to the foyer, to the drive, to the parking lot where people are parking their car? I mean, if you're talking about turning the typical concert on its head, a complete 180, how far can you take something like this?
Well, obviously, what I hope is that people take this home with them, and it is the beginning of a conversation that I really never had as a child growing up, a conversation that may not be happening enough in America today. You know, I've spoken with a lot of parents here who grew up in the 1960s, and when I ask them, do you talk to your children about your history? They say, I want to protect my child, and I don't want them to know how I was treated in the 1960s. And I can understand that. You don't want to pain your children, but it is a responsibility to carry history from one generation to the next. And I hope that at the very least, my piece is the first step in a conversation.
When creating a new work, how do you know when it's completed?
That's a great question. I struggled for a long time with how to finish this piece. And in fact, it doesn't end in a clean and clear way. And I realized that my inability to do that was because the story hasn't ended and that there is no answer yet. I think that's part of writing a work that's realistic, that's not sugar-coated. It is a hopeful work, but it is a realistic piece that addresses the fact that we haven't achieved everything, that there is still a struggle, and that the piece goes on, as you were saying, after you've left the concert hall.
You were born in the Netherlands. You grew up in Israel, Nigeria, and Milwaukee. How did that influence you as a composer?
I grew up with a grandmother who was a very, very serious amateur musician. And when I was about 10 years old, she told me that as a birthday present, she would get me a Walkman, and my first Walkman. And we went to the store, and she let me choose any album that I wanted. Now, this was a woman who was deeply invested in classical music, and she sang Schubert and Brahms and Mozart. And I chose Run DMC, Tougher Than Leather. And she didn't talk to me for a week, and then she passed away. And I think that maybe if I saw enough Freudian analysts, they would tell me that I became a composer as a kind of penance to my grandmother. But to answer your question, all kinds of music has entered me as a composer, and Run DMC is as important to me as Bach, and growing up learning how to dance in Nigeria is just as important to me as learning preludes and fugues. And all of that has entered who I am as a composer. So my time in Africa, my time in Europe, and my time in America has all been really a part of who I am.
Do you feel you've found your voice as a composer? Or is that a constant evolutionary type of thing?
When I will be able to say that I found my voice, there will be no point in writing the next piece. Someone once said that every piece is essentially the same, that you're trying to compose the same piece throughout your life. I like that idea that I'm constantly striving for something that I haven't been able to reach yet. And I think that that's what pushes me to the next piece.